You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 40. On the last show, we talked about 10 things to do on your first visit to New Orleans. If you've never been to New Orleans, or if you're having visitors soon, it'll certainly help you out. And if you are experienced, you'll still find some insider tips. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Today's show is going to be about Abraham Lincoln, his visits to New Orleans, and how they shaped his thoughts as the 16th President of the United States. If you follow the news in New Orleans, you've watched the debate about the removal of four Confederate-era statues here in New Orleans. I've been asked a bunch lately about whether I was going to do an episode about that topic, and I kicked it around for a while. The more I researched and thought about it, the more I came back to Abraham Lincoln. Had he not become president, would we even be debating these statues at all? These thoughts led me to create the show you're going to hear today, including an interview with author Richard Campanella, who you met back in episode 36. This is a bit of a long one, so I'm going to skip the iTunes reviews today and jump straight into the discussion. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll see you on the other side. Hey, y'all. My guest today is the first returning guest to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. He's a professor with the Tulane School of Architecture. He's the author of 9 books, including the one we're going to talk about today, and hundreds of articles. He's also the only 2-time winner of the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities Book of the Year Award. I also think it's more than fair to call him the geographer of New Orleans. Welcome back to the show, Richard Campanella.
Thank you very much.
Hey, it's so good. Thank you for taking the time to come back and talk with us today.
You bet.
So for those of you who might not have listened, and you should, the last time Richard and I got together, we talked about Bourbon Street and specifically how Bourbon Street happened. Richard has a fabulous book that you should check out about the history of Bourbon Street, but we really got into what makes it arguably the most important street in the city today and its origins. And so when we finished that conversation, we were talking about some of the other books that Richard's written. And as I started thinking about today's topic, recently in the news in New Orleans has been a big discussion about 4 Confederate-era statues, or statues celebrating, if you will, the Confederacy. And I didn't want to do anything about those statues, but I got to thinking about, well, what happened way before those statues? And it sort of took me to Abraham Lincoln. And then I remembered a conversation Richard and I had that President Lincoln, long before he was president, had actually visited New Orleans. And so that was the reason for me coming back to you to talk to you today, Richard. Richard's written a book about Lincoln in New Orleans, and specifically his journeys to and from New Orleans in the early to mid-1800s, which we'll get into. And I just thought that'd be an interesting tie-in. So thanks for doing this.
You're welcome.
I guess what I wanted to start with was a little bit of the premise of the book and the fact that where Lincoln was and what his life was like, if we could, before he came to New Orleans.
Lincoln was prototypical of a generation of young Westerners whose families came over the Appalachians after the Revolution, late 1700s, mm-hmm. and started settling in what New Orleanians would have called the upcountry. Yeah. And by that is meant the Ohio River Valley, the upper Mississippi Valley. They moved into those areas. Of course, indigenous populations were displaced and pushed mm-hmm. further westward, or combated, or died of disease, and started clearing forests, growing crops, and establishing a frontier exchange economy whereby the corn you raise might be swapped with the hogs that your neighbor raises.
Mm,
and to the point that they fulfill local needs. Mm-hmm. But eventually they reach the point of developing surpluses.
Sure.
And what they lack is cash, Mexican silver, produced merchandise, things like coffee and sugar, things that were unobtainable there. And thus the beginnings of this interaction between the upcountry, usually young males like Lincoln, and New Orleans in the form of the flatboat trade. And that is the economic circumstance that brings Lincoln to New Orleans.
I see. One of the things that somehow I think a lot of people maybe overlook with Lincoln, particularly in the time frame we're going to talk, is that he wasn't living in Missouri. He wasn't living in Kentucky. He had actually his family had moved to Indiana.
Correct.
And so what was the genesis of that move to Indiana?
There were very explicitly, and Lincoln himself spells this out clearly in a brief autobiography he penned in 1860. Thomas Lincoln, his father, moved the family out of Kentucky across the Ohio and into Indiana for two reasons. The second one was discomfort with slavery. Mm-hmm. The first reason was the legal insecurity of land titles. And I should explain here, it was one of my interests as a geographer is cadastral systems, and that is land surveying systems. On the Kentucky side, that was old British America, right?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Kentucky was an extension of Virginia. This was a British colony. And their surveying systems is known as meets and bounds, which is a very irregular surveying system whereby the land is delineated from that boulder to that oak tree to that road to that river confluence back to this boulder over here. Mm. The problem with that is the tree dies, the boulder rolls,
right.
The road is rerouted, etc. And so early Americans after the Revolution were constantly suing each other over disputed property lines and titles. It was a huge problem.
Sure.
And to the point that, and you know, consider the quandary that a Western farmer would be in. You're going to put all this work into clearing a forest and building a cabin and planting crops only to learn that you're on someone else's property. So that was the number one reason. Why did he go to Indiana? Well, there was a general sense at that time that slavery would never cross the Ohio River, and that proved to be true. There was also, because that was the Northwest Territories, the English did not survey into that area. It was open ground from the American perspective for their cadastral system, which is the Jeffersonian grid, the township and range, which is perfectly orderly. There's zero disputes. Everything is perfectly measured like a geometry problem. Mm-hmm. And so for those reasons, Thomas Lincoln took his family in 1816. Abraham would have been 7 years old at the time. And they settled in the vicinity of in Spencer County, in southern Indiana, not too far from Rockport.
And you get into that again. Your book is called Lincoln in New Orleans, and you get into some of those early issues with property disputes that Thomas ran into. I think a couple of times.
Oh yeah.
Before he said this
it
is enough.
Them. Right. It chased them from, in fact, that they moved out of the place where Lincoln was born to where he grew into childhood, a little place called Knobs Creek. And that was also driven by this this big legal problem.
So they moved to Indiana. Lincoln, as you mentioned, about 7 years old at the time, grows up in this relatively poor experience, country experience, seems to really become a woodsman, typical of the time, it seems like, in terms of working the farm, working, cutting wood, is a very large man, as we know,
yes,
even as a child,
is
a big kid.
Yeah.
And so then the idea of the flatboats at that time period, so the 1810s, 1816s into the 1820s, flatboats were the primary way, as I understand it, that people in the Midwest would come down if they were going to sell wares or trade wares down the Mississippi River valleys.
That's correct. And let me briefly describe types, vessel types floating the Mississippi
be my next
at
question.
This time.
Sure.
Yeah. The big problem at that time was going, I'm talking prior to the 18-teens, okay, was contra-current navigation, going against the current.
Sure.
Going down with the current was much easier. And so for this, you could really just, with the labor of putting together a bulky raft, you could float down with it. They didn't have to be streamlined. They didn't have to be beautiful, and they weren't. They had to be strong, and they had to be waterproof, particularly for rain, because you didn't want moisture the commodities you were bringing down. But and so a flatboat was was essentially a big bulky raft with walls and some sort of shelter on it. Mm-hmm. Some of them were pretty fancy. They had their own calefaction if they were coming down in the dead of winter. But they were designed to be temporary because once you floated down to your destination, be it Natchez or Bayou Saro, most of them came to New Orleans, you couldn't go against the current. And so they would disassemble them, sell off the scrap wood, which was used for everything from firewood to fences, to planking the levee, and famously for bargeboard cottages,
right,
which we have all over New Orleans. They couldn't go against the current, so a different vessel had to be created to go against the current, and that was called a keelboat. And a keelboat had to be streamlined. If you would, I think that they almost had like a Mesopotamian look to them.
Okay, sure.
If you picture the vessel that Lewis and Clark took up the Missouri, mm-hmm. that's a keelboat.
Okay,
they were long and narrow. They had places for multiple oarsmen. Mm-hmm. And they rowed and steered and pulled and dragged themselves against the current. It's very difficult. They would have a sail in case the winds were blowing in the right direction. They would have a cord on board where quite literally in really tough spots, one of the crew would put the cord in his mouth, jump in the river, swim up to a tree, loop it around the tree, and they would pull themselves up. They would also read the river because, as you know, we have these eddies and cross currents where you could look out across the river and it almost seems like an optical illusion, except it isn't, that it's going downriver in one section. It's actually going upriver in another.
Right.
So they would zip across the river, catch one of those, and fight their way upriver. So it was tough, and keelboats were something that technology could possibly replace. And that, of course, came with the development of the adaptation of steam engines to vessels, and then, importantly for the Mississippi, two other things. The development of shallow draft hulls, because you have to pull into beachy banks and things like that. And then also a legal clarity that the Mississippi River would be completely open, because some of the early inventors wanted to lock up rights on the Mississippi. So it took a full 10 years. The first steamboat comes down to New Orleans in 1812, and it's called the New Orleans. It comes down from Pittsburgh, demonstrates the technology, but it takes another 12 years for the Supreme Court to completely free up and validate that the Mississippi River is completely open. So what we have then is steamboats pretty much antiquate keelboats. Mm. And keelboats largely disappear, except for narrow tributaries that are unserved by steamboats.
Sure.
Flatboats, however, form a symbiotic relationship with steamboats because they're so cheap to build if you have access to the free timber.
Right.
It's just your manual labor. They don't use fuel. You float down by yourself, that they were actually able to coexist with the steamboats.
I see.
And so from the 18-teens and 20s, right up until the Civil War, what you had coming downriver from the upcountry to New Orleans was a vast armada changing every moment of flatboats and steamboats coming down, but only steamboats going back up.
Right.
So if you were up on the bluffs in Vicksburg and Natchez looking over the river on any afternoon in 1827, you would see a little speck of a flatboat floating down. 10 minutes later, you see maybe two more. Then you see a steamboat going the opposite direction. Constant. And so this is the economic system that Lincoln participated in. He, as exceptional as he became later in life and in our social memory today, he was absolutely shoulder to shoulder average at the time of steering these crops, commodities, harvests down to New Orleans, selling them off, turning it into cash, selling off the flatboat, spending a couple of weeks footloose and fancy free in the big city, and then taking a steamboat back up as a deck passenger.
I see. And so in your book, you kind of talk about flatboats, and you just mentioned it. They seem to come in all shapes and sizes, mm-hmm. right? From what we can tell, it seems like the size of his boat was sort of very average, maybe?
It was on the smaller side. A flatboatman in this era could be dropped into two categories. The professionals who did this for a living, they were kind of the Western equivalent, antebellum Western equivalent of truck drivers.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they steered commodity. Whoever paid, they drove it to market.
Right.
Then they were the farmer flatboatmen who were amateurs, usually the sons or hired hands of the person, the family putting up the crop. And so they tended to be smaller operations. The professional ones would have crews of, you know, 6, 10, 12 people. The farmer ones, just a couple. And that's what Lincoln did. There was just two of them. So the circumstances were that in 1828, and we could talk a bit how I nailed down the date.
I think it's fascinating.
He was, by this time, he's 19 years old.
Right.
And I should say that, he grew up in very poor, humble, rural circumstances. Lincoln, in later in life, did not like to talk or write about himself. And so he writes very sparingly about his youth. But he was extraordinary in one regard compared to his parents and his surroundings. He was extraordinarily intelligent, and in a kind of deep intellectual, almost brooding sort of way. And so his intellect steered him away from his environment, to the point that tensions developed among the family and this little farmstead in Spencer County. So what did an inquisitive youth with this brain just aching for raw material, what did you do in that day? You gravitated to rivers, rivers with a lifeblood that connected you to the rest of the nation and the rest of the world. The Ohio River near Rockport was that place. And so starting around 1826-27, he forms a little business. He's an entrepreneur of rowing passengers out to steamboats so they didn't have to stop. So he'd like a taxi service.
Okay, like a water taxi.
Yeah, exactly. It was a water taxi. And this connects him with this wider world. He hears the French language. He hears the Spanish language. He gets newspapers coming in from Pittsburgh and New York and New Orleans. And so he starts to connect rivers with that which is cosmopolitan and that which is connected with intellect and a broader world. So the opportunity arises with the wealthiest man in town, a man named James Gentry. The community was called Gentryville, who had a son who had been a flatboatman before. His name was Alan, but Alan was a bit of, he's a young guy, and James knew his son was not quite responsible enough to go alone. And so James wanted to hire a helping hand for his son who would captain the voyage, and saw in Lincoln that strong, mature, level-headed type that he was looking for. So he hires him at $8 to join Alan Gentry to take a load of harvests, and we don't know exactly what they are, down to New Orleans to turn into cash. If they were anything like most other farmer flatboatmen coming out of southern Indiana in the late 1820s, hominy corn and smoked pork meat, barrel pork, which was packed in like saline, like briny water, as well as smoked meat, would be two of a much larger number of two of the most common products that would come down. But they would bring anything that would sell. It could be anything from pumpkins to the wood used in hoop skirts, anything that sold.
Well, and your book talks about some of the local crops, but also as we get further into the story, the idea that they would sometimes pick up things along the way.
Yep.
Flatboatmen.
Yep.
And so again, to set the stage, and you mentioned $8, you meant $8 a month to set the stage. So this was $8 a month.
Right.
He's hired to sort of offset the sun. And obviously, Lincoln was a big man, big even at that age, a big guy, strong by all accounts and intellectual. So then we get into, now we're into 1827-ish, and you go through a great level of detail about, there's no exact...
Excruciating, folks.
I don't think excruciating, but we'll save some of it for the book, about there's no definitive account of when they left and when they got to New Orleans. So through a lot of extraction and extrapolation, you arrive at basically the spring of 1828.
Yes, and specifically April 18th or 19th, 1828, that I would not bet $1 million, but would bet $1,000, knowing that no one could debunk me, that is the probable date that he and Alan Gentry pulled out of Rockport, Indiana, heading for New Orleans. I should note for listeners that Lincoln did not leave a journal. Okay, so all of this, there's no true primary source, except for the few words he said about the voyage later in life, and then lots of historical secondary accounts of what his neighbors remember him talking about this. So what I found myself with was, and I should note that I'm not a historian, purely speaking, nor I am a Lincolnist. I'm a historical geographer.
Right.
Who specializes in New Orleans. And that actually benefited me in this project because being very familiar with primary sources here in New Orleans, I was able to discover things that Lincolnists operating elsewhere would probably not know about.
Right.
So long story short, I pulled together a huge array of clues and plotted them out in space and time and came up with a preponderance of evidence of when his most likely launch date was. And I'll just focus on two of them here. One, which was a very important one, was that the Wharfinger reports here, that is the Port of New Orleans, would record whenever a steamboat or a flatboat would arrive.
Right.
They would pay a wharfage fee. It was all documented. Those records have been lost for the 2 years that Lincoln, and many other years, the 2 years that Lincoln came, plus it's very spotty.
Sure.
And I turned this town upside down looking for those flatboat manifests and the wharfmaster reports. So what I did discover, however, is that while those original documents are lost, the newspaper, one of the French-speaking newspapers, would record that information as port news, maritime news, a day or two later. And so I mined that data, plotted it out, and what I found was that spring of 1828 was a really good year for flatboating. It was one of the highest water levels on record, which is good for flatboating for two reasons. The higher the water in the Mississippi is, the faster
speed.
It flows.
Sure.
So you're going like 6, 7, 8 miles an hour instead of 3 or 4. It also means you get above those sandbars, and it drastically reduces the dreaded circumstance of getting caught on a shoal. And to be sure, I found scores and scores and scores of flatboats arriving in that May, June, July period, and it takes about 6 weeks to get down here. So this is shining very good light on April. And to be sure, I found some that left from Indiana.
Right.
And they didn't quite describe Gentry's name or Lincoln's name. Boy, would I love to have found that. But this is what I mean by a preponderance of evidence. The other theories is that he came in 1829 and other areas. And I checked those, and very, very few flatboats came in that period. So this plus a number of other clues led me to the mid-April period. So how can I bring this any finer? And after Lincoln was assassinated, his former law partner by the name of William Herndon, Billy Herndon, had the foresight to try to figure out who was this incredible man. We've only known him for 5 years. He came onto the national scene in 1860. He saved the Union, ended slavery. Now he's dead. Who was this guy? So he had the foresight of going out to Kentucky and Indiana and finding these now elderly people who remember Lincoln in his youth. And this is most of what we know about Lincoln's youth comes from those interviews that he did in 1865-66. And so Lincoln had a young lady had a crush on Lincoln. And ironically, she would later marry Allen Gentry. And she recalls she would be in her 60s by this time, I suppose. She recalled one night when she was basically hanging out with both Allen before they were married as well as Lincoln on the flatboat the night before they left. And she recalls commenting on the moon that was setting in the sky, in the western sky on that early evening. And I thought to myself, okay, I know it's April. I know it's 1828. What moon sets in the early evening? It's a young crescent. When does a young crescent come? It comes a couple of days after the new moon. That you can look up.
Right.
So leveraging off that, I found the new moon, added a couple of days for the crescent to develop, but then one or two days for them to launch the day or so after. And that narrowed me down to April 18th or 19th, 1828. And this also explains why there is a crescent moon on the upper right of the cover.
I didn't catch that when
book.
I read the book.
So I joke with my wife, whenever we see a crescent moon, we said, there's Lincoln's moon.
And it is an interesting story in the first sort of maybe a fourth of the book where you really kind of walk the reader through how you posit that. Yeah. And while I understand that you can't definitively say it was this date, there's a lot of evidence that can kind of point you to that direction and support it. And I think for people interested in that, there really is. It's almost like a mystery novel walking you through, well, how do we determine that this is more likely?
Like detective work. It was very. It was so fun to do that I wanted to share for readers for two reasons. One, because, well, three reasons. One, you learn a lot from. You learn a lot about history by doing it. Two, the detective, the methodology is so fun that I wanted to share that. And three, I wanted to document my thinking so that other researchers and historians could either add to it, debunk it, test it, you know, the scientific method taken to historical research. I should point out, why is this so important? Who cares exactly when? Because this book is about Lincoln in New Orleans, it was critical for me to hammer out the time window as best as I could in which he experienced the city, because then I could explore what was going on in the city to which Lincoln was exposed.
Well, and this gets you are like anticipating my questions, because as I picked up the book, that was the premise I started from. To be honest, I wasn't so interested in Lincoln in Indiana, but what was New Orleans like when Lincoln got here? And then as you start to dive into your book, you really start to realize, well, in order to know that, you have to have the time frame, particularly to make it as precise or as accurate as possible. And so you mentioned that. So they mid-April now, they've loaded up the boat. They've built the boat, we should say.
Correct.
They've loaded up the boat. They head down the river. And so let's talk a little bit about that journey. And certainly the upper part of the journey is very different than as they get into the Mississippi River Valley.
Right. The way I pieced this together was, once again, leveraging off those various clues in those 1865 interviews, and then finding the accounts of other flatboat men. And many did leave journals that are known to historians, as well as learning about river conditions and the experience of coming, you know, that Cairo, Illinois, where the Ohio River plunges into the Mississippi. You'd be surprised. There were a lot of flatboatman accounts right around 1828, 29. Why 1828? That was that high water river, that high water year. And so I kind of pieced together the experience that Lincoln probably had in a generalized sense, and then imbuing in, you know, specific experiences.
Well, and as I read your book, it strikes me that on the one hand, there's a bit of a Huck Finn quality, Tom Sawyer quality. But on the other hand, the river's not exactly peaceful, even in the
dangerous
Ohio River.
That's right.
And there are logs coming down.
That's right.
And it's,
that's
the current, it is, the high water, which is helpful, but also dangerous in some cases.
Flatboatmen led lives that one might compare to a soldier in war, where there might be hours and hours and hours of marching and perhaps boredom and perhaps waiting, punctuated by moments of sheer terror and excruciating toil. And then you have the conditions, the wind, the sun. They're almost completely exposed. They do have a little shelter on board. The river is complex to read. It's essentially uncontrolled at this period. You don't have cleared banks and levees at that time.
Right.
So the flatboat is coming down. There are these two side oars, so then you have a steering oar. So Lincoln was born for the steering oar. 6'4", strong, wiry, huge hands. So when you're on the steering oar, it's essentially a rudder, and you guide yourself downriver. But there's this phenomenon called river shears, which are not unlike wind shears in jet streams in the sky.
Right.
These errant unexpected movements coming in directions that are contrary to where most of the movement is coming from. And if you were on the steering oar and a shear hit, it could pull that steering oar suddenly, and if you're holding onto it, either break it or rocket you into the river, and you're probably going to drown there. There are also what they call planters and sawyers. A planter was a tree with its root system filled with dirt and rocks such that that weight, once the tree fell into the river, would pull it below the surface.
Okay.
And when they bobbed up and down, it was called a sawyer because it looked like a saw going up and down. Mm-hmm. These things are all over the place. So you're flatboating along, and then suddenly, almost like a breaching whale, this gigantic trunk pops up. Sometimes that trunk would hit the hull of the flatboat and crack it open. Even if it only slightly damaged it, you'd have water coming in that could end up creating mildew on the corn, and the whole voyage would be ruined.
Sure.
And then you have the eddy currents. Then you have winter. People actually did sometimes leave in winter.
Mm-hmm.
If they tied up at night and camped out, sometimes the water would freeze and they'd be locked in. Other times they would get trapped on sandbars. And then you had the question of nighttime travel.
Mm-hmm.
It was very attractive because, first of all, you don't have that glaring sun, and you could double your speed down to New Orleans by going essentially 24 hours a day.
Right. Sure.
But then came the dangers. And, you could get lost. You could get lost in this. You could crash into a steamboat. So many of them, including Lincoln and Gentry, tied up at night, mm-hmm. using just a cable, or they would pull over to the shore and tie up and just camp out. But this exposed them to the danger of marauders and thieves. And this happened to Lincoln. As he arrived in Louisiana, and I should say that as he comes past Memphis and deeper into the South, particularly after Vicksburg and Natchez, for the first time in his life, he's surrounded by large-scale Southern plantation slavery.
Mm.
Now, he had seen slavery in Kentucky, but it was small-scale farm, as opposed to vast, 600 enslaved people.
Mm-hmm.
And so he arrives at what he called Louisiana's Sugar Coast. That's the term.
How far into the journey were they? How far was the journey overall in terms of over 1,000 miles, from Indiana?
Right. It's actually hard to compute exactly because, remember, the river has all these meanders, and a lot of it has been straightened out.
I see.
So it's about 1,500 miles, and it took them around, given the lingering that they did, that's what Lincoln called it, lingering on the Sugar Coast, probably about 5 to 6 weeks to come down.
So I didn't mean to interrupt you. So they've come back. They've come below.
He comes out of Baton Rouge, which is significant because, one, when you come down from Baton Rouge, you come out of the Mississippi Valley and onto the Mississippi Deltaic Plain.
Mm.
When you're in the valley, the bluffs and terraces are over your head. When you're on the Deltaic Plain, the landscape is below your head, right?
Yeah, which
the
we
river
see today.
Is the highest thing around, the levees, and then the landscape is below the river for the most part.
Right.
And so topographically, everything changes. Agriculturally, it changes from mostly cotton to mostly sugarcane. Culturally, it changes from mostly Anglo-Saxon to mostly Francophone French Creole. The architecture changes from mostly neoclassical and Greek Revival to kind of a West Indian French Creole,
mm-hmm.
with the double pitch hip roofs.
Right.
And so Lincoln, in his own words, describes as lingering along the Louisiana Sugar Coast. What does this mean? They're going every plantation. The plantations were up close to the river, and then the crops would go back farther to the swamp. Each one had a landing, and they were known as whatever the plantation's name, landing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the way the plantation interacted with the rest of the world.
Mm.
So they were constantly being visited by basically traveling salesmen, the flatboatmen.
Offering their goods.
Yeah, if they need, and a typical exchange here would be that the planter family would buy barrel pork, really the cheapest cuts of pork meat, stored in briny water, and sold. And what was this used for? As for very cheap, high protein food for the enslaved population. So they would get this pork, they would also get corn, wheat, and they would exchange it for maybe some hogsheads of sugar or any other citrus. And so the flatboatman would either take that to New Orleans, even though he came from 1,000 miles,
right.
Here he is selling Louisiana local stuff, or he would bring it to the next flat. So they would linger going from one to one, just bartering, selling, whatever they could do. So somewhere around Convent, Louisiana, and I took some time to pin down exactly where, they tie up for the night, and they are attacked by a group of African-American men. It's a bit of a mystery as to who they were, whether they were Maroons, which is escaped slaves, or whether they were enslaved. Apparent circumstances indicate that they understood and reacted to the English that Lincoln and Gentry yelled back and forth. One bluffed, one shouted out, "Get the gun," to the other. And at that point, the attackers ran away, which indicates that they understood English, which might indicate that they were Anglo-African Americans as opposed to Franco-African Americans. And so it's hard to pin down exactly. But Lincoln was struck with a club, with a blunt object over his right temple. There's all sorts of incredible ironies here, as well as incredible moments, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say that if someone clubs you hard in a violent fight at night and hits you in your right temple, that you probably came very close to dying, mm-hmm. had it been a little bit. And so I think we could safely say, without being melodramatic, that Lincoln was almost murdered the night before he first sat in New Orleans. Mm. How different history would have played
out. Sure, right.
And the circumstances of the attack are so profoundly ironic and almost to the point of poignant.
Well, and I also think as you're describing the attack, and even in the trading coming down, they are trading and selling barrel pork, which, of course, they had to have known barrel pork was primarily sold to feed slaves. So that had to have been, I would think, I think it's reasonable to say, that was probably on his mind, a well-read, intelligent person, that of all the crops and things that they were bringing, that was part of it.
Yeah, although I should remind that I point to corn and smoked hog meat pork and barrel pork as very, very typical and common products that were brought down.
Right.
Whether he actually did that, there's no evidence
because there's no
records and he never.
Sure.
But he would have seen, and this is the point I make after he arrives in New Orleans, which I put around May 13th and May 14th of 1828. He arrives at the flatboat wharf, and we could talk about that, but once he starts exploring the city, and he's in the city for about a month, about 4 weeks, that what he would have been overwhelmed by, given his powers of observation and thought, would have been this vast cityscape of the slave trade.
Yeah, and I want to jump into that. If we could just sort of, for listeners, kind of give them an idea of, so where would that wharf have been set against modern day New Orleans?
Very good. That wharf would have been, for local listeners, picture North Peter Street, okay? I'm sorry, South Peter Street. North Peter Street goes to the French Quarter. Mm-hmm. South Peter Street coming through the warehouse district and into those big open fields by the convention center, by the bridge, and the old Nopsey Market Street power plant. Okay?
Sure.
Okay, it's kind of an empty field now. Now, you might be a little surprised that I'm not pointing to the riverfront. The river has shifted over the past 200 years. So where the flatboat wharf was when Lincoln landed is actually landbound by a couple hundred feet now. So why there? Obviously, the flatboat traffic is coming from upriver. So this would have been the upper reaches of New Orleans, and it made hydrological sense in terms of port management to let the upriver craft dock upriver from the city proper. Downriver from the city proper, that is, in the French Quarter itself going down to Marigny, the lower parts of the city was the perfect place for ocean-going and coastwise shipping coming up the river, sailboats. Mm-hmm. Sailing vessels to dock. In between on about four blocks on either side of Canal Street was the optimal place for the steamboat traffic to dock. So the flatboat wharf would have been upriver. And once again, I kind of used this preponderance of evidence technique to nail down his most likely, that's the best I can do, I can't say for certain, landing spot. And I would put it on the city side of the Market Street power plant. So next time you're around the Lower Garden District riverfront and you see that big hulking brick building with the two smokestacks, look at the side facing you, the facing Chapultepec Street, and picture a few hundred feet on either side of there and imagine scores and scores of these flatboats pulling up there, throwing out a cord, unloading, and that's probably where Lincoln was.
Well, and as I was reading the book and I was thinking about people from out of town, it's not terribly far from Mardi Gras World.
Correct.
If people have been to Mardi Gras World, except that you sort of think not on the riverside, but on the land
on
side.
On the land side, that's
because
right.
that was part of the river back that's then. Right. I think that's an right. interesting visual. So nonetheless, they get here after about a month of journey down the river. They land essentially somewhere close to that area, and they are greeted once they get off and start to sell their wares with this New Orleans, as you describe in the book, that it would have been unavoidable to miss the slave trade.
Right.
And so as they wander in, effectively, that's sort of where the town, the city of Lafayette was coming in, or right on the edge of New Orleans. You say they probably had 3 to 4 weeks here in New Orleans to explore,
yes.
to sell their wares.
Yes, and I base that on using the reverse detective work of going back upriver. So long story short, I found evidence that he's definitely back in a certain date in June in 1828.
Okay.
And in July of 1828, and calculated typical steamboat length of time to take a steamboat from New Orleans back up to Indiana, back that out, and that narrows down roughly mid-May to mid-June that they're hanging out in New Orleans. And flatboatmen typically did this. Why would a young guy want to hang out in New Orleans and be away from his family and not leave a journal?
Seems like history repeating itself these days a little bit.
There is an element of that. When we see young people coming to New Orleans, be it spring break, there's that element of viewing New Orleans as this place where kind of what you do here is off the record, and it's this isolated, exotic city, and where certain behaviors you would never do at home can be done here. And this was the spirit of flatboatmen. They knew this. They understood it, and they behaved in this way to the point that flatboatmen had a nasty reputation in antebellum New Orleans.
Well, and
locals did not like them.
Just as an aside, Richard and I were together on episode 36, how Bourbon Street happened, and we got into that sort of not that long after the time period that you're describing now, how New Orleans, you've come off the Storyville era, and New Orleans has sort of become a tourist destination, and often and largely for men, right? Single men or men without other encumbrances, wandering the city and all the vices and the good that comes in. So you talk in the book quite a bit about setting the scene, and you talk about Chartist Street and the significance of Hewlett's, I believe.
Hewlett's Exchange. Chartist Street in particular was the one street that you just had to see if you were visiting New Orleans in the 1820s, 1830s. Folks might find this a little surprising. I could tell you it was not Bourbon Street. As you'll recall from our previous conversation, Bourbon Street was really just another downtown street. It wasn't special in any way. It was not famous. It wouldn't be for basically another 100 years. Canal Street was mostly residential at this time. It had not become the great shopping emporium that it would about 20 or 30 years after all this.
Right.
It was Charter Street, and right behind that it was Royal Street. Charters was filled with these beautiful Parisian displays, these retail emporium. You could find all sorts of fancy goods, imported foods and wines, and delicacies coming in from Italy and France. And it was a must-see sight, and people wrote about it. You dressed to your finest on Charter Street. And then there was this intersection at St. Louis, which is a very significant intersection. If folks could picture where the Napoleon House is today, right around there, which was one of the bustling spots in the professional scene there. There were newspaper offices there, a lot of law offices. And then there was the Exchange House, Right at the corner where the hotel is now.
So where the Omni Royal Orleans
exactly.
is today.
Right where that little laundry and like service area okay. is. That building is a reconstruction. That's 1960. But right at that corner, and I think about this every time I pass it, had a long history going from turn of the 19th century clear up until the Civil War of exchanges slash auction houses slash hotels. And I should briefly explain that an exchange was kind of this all-purpose social slash professional place that where men of power could meet, eat, drink, and conduct business. They were the coffee houses, they were the saloons, they were the hotels. They were these what we might call shared spaces today that were designed for human interaction. And in this day, before telephones and internet and even before telegraphs, this meant face-to-face meetings, and it meant big cities. And so we had exchange hotels, which were kind of like conference hotels that took care of all your needs. There would be a bank. There'd be a pool hall. Oh, there'd be a restaurant. Everything you needed for these long-term guests.
Okay.
And so you have these men, southern men of power, interacting with northern businessmen, investors, financiers, and they're buying and selling things. And how was this conducted? It was conducted through auctions. And what was auctioned top of the list was real estate. And enslaved people, according to Louisiana law, were considered to be real estate. Mm. So when slaves were auctioned, they were done so in the real estate auctions, as opposed to the auctions for vehicles and animals and things like that. And so there was at this particular corner, there was Maspero's Exchange. It was Tremontland's Exchange. Then John Hewlett bought it. And in the period that we're talking about here, 1828, it was known as Hewlett's Exchange, and everyone knew about it.
Hmm. And a couple of things jumped out at me in the book. One, the idea when you talked about Charters and that corner, Charters and St. Louis streets being really sort of the hub and the important part set against our recent discussion about Bourbon Street. I think most listeners today would, the moment you talk about streets in French Quarter, your mind is drawn to Bourbon Street. And yet it was
That's
Charters,
right.
which today in some respects is sometimes overlooked a little. People will talk about, hey, go to Royal Street,
That's right.
go to Bourbon Street.
That's right.
You don't often hear people say, hey, go check out Charters.
Uh-huh.
And then
uh-huh.
the second, and you give really graphic, and I don't mean gory, but graphic details of examples of listings in your book where they'll give a couple of words and a description of a human being, of a slave being auctioned off that could be as simple or as mundane as reading Craigslist today.
Yes.
And it's striking to me in the similarity there. So it is almost like you read Craigslist and you see a listing for any kind of property.
Right.
And the very much the same thing. A name, you know, male or female, maybe height, maybe one characteristic, like you could be describing any other piece of property.
Cold, utilitarian, profoundly exploitive, and tough to read. And every one of those quotes that I pull out is from period newspapers and other documents, transfer papers and whatnot, from exactly that mid-May to mid-June era. And that was the importance of nailing down that time window, because I wanted the actual humans to which he was potentially exposed. So I mentioned that everyone knew about Hewlett's Exchange. I get this from the many travelogues and travel writings that people kind of taking the grand tour,
right.
these outspoken individuals coming from the Northeast and England and Europe who would visit American cities and opine and observe and pass judgment. They left behind a lot. And, you know, these are not entirely, they were very judgmental, but in many cases, it's the best we have. And case after case after case, they would go in to see this spectacle at Hewlett's Exchange. And some would write defensively about it. Others would be absolutely appalled and horrified by it. But they were curious about it. And I think it's safe to say that Hewlett's Exchange was an honest-to-goodness tourist attraction in evoking both horror as well as curiosity. But people went in there and visited it. So given the fame and notoriety of Charter Street, given the fame and notoriety and infamy of Hewlett's Exchange and the inquisitive, observant, curious aspect of Lincoln's intellect, it's probably reasonable.
Sure.
To conject that he would have explored Charter Street and he would have come across Euless Exchange. Can I get him through the door? No.
Right.
Are there clues in those secondary sources from the 1865 interviews that he witnessed auctions and other clues later in life? Yes, there are. So again, preponderance of evidence, but no smoking gun.
Well, and again, just trying to set the scene, which you do so eloquently in the book. And I should have pointed out, I should have mentioned earlier, I'm speaking with Richard Campanella, and you can find him online at richcampanella.com and also on Twitter at Nola Campanella. But you were talking about it in the book. It certainly seems plausible, if not probable, that he would have made his way there. It was one of the largest tourist attractions, again, at the time. You also talked about in the book that this was the time period when Congo Square was very active as a vibrant Sunday meeting ground for slaves and for free men of color, and that was also a tourist attraction.
You bet it was, to the point that you could find it listed in city directories as Congo Square, Place Congo, Circus Square, comma, the place where the Negroes congregate and dance and make music. And I'm quoting almost precisely from city directories. City directories were the Google search of this age. So if you were a traveler and you had some free time in this great city of New Orleans, you wanted some fun things to do, you'd open up a city directory and you'd look for it. And everyone knew about Congo Square. People would go there and comment on the spectacle of enslaved Africa. This was their one day off, and it was the one space where they could congregate legally. And so once again, an inquisitive young man visiting for the first time probably likely would have gone there, because we know just when every other visitor went there.
Right. And the last thing that struck me in your book about that time period, sort of just an interesting juxtaposition, is it's 1828. So the other thing that happens is it's 13 years after the Battle of New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, Andrew Jackson is campaigning for the presidency of the United States. So in today's world...
Also a Westerner.
Also a Westerner. And in today's world, obviously the iconic image you see of New Orleans so often with the statue of Andrew Jackson in the square. But it's certainly likely that, or at least possible, that Lincoln would have known about that, obviously, and may very well have chosen to go visit Chalmette. Or certainly that would have been something that people might have done.
That was another enormous tourist attraction. As you probably know, January 8th was a well-known, it wasn't technically a national holiday, but people said it was second only to July 4th. Everyone knew January 8th. This was the case clear up to the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you went to New Orleans, you went to the fields of Chalmette to see the glorious victory of January 8th. I've seen evidence of Union soldiers stationed in the city during the Civil War. When they had a day off, what would they do? They'd go down to Chalmette as tourists. So there's, and you know, there were daily steamboats. You could take a steamboat down there for like a couple of bucks. And,
which is interesting, even today, right?
You
can take the Creole Queen.
Today we had a previous president who was compared to Lincoln and a current president who compares himself to Jackson.
Right.
So here we are talking about Lincoln and Jackson even today.
The more things change, right, the more they stay the same. So nonetheless, I love that in the book and in your discussion just now, it really brings to life, while I understand it's sort of caveated, we can't know with absolute surety where Lincoln was, we can certainly posit the things that he might have done or that any given visitor in that time period. So they spend a few weeks here, they head back up, they take a steamboat, which again, had they come 20 years earlier, they would have likely walked back up. Right.
Right. In fact, just to go back a bit, Thomas Lincoln, his father, came down to New Orleans on a flatboat back in 1806, right after the Louisiana Purchase. And back then, steamboats hadn't been invented yet. So he definitely came down on a flatboat with someone named Isaac Bush. And so he probably, if he was anything like the other ones, took a keelboat to Natchez and then walked or rode horses from inn to inn along the Natchez Trace back to the upcountry.
So Lincoln and Gentry go back in the summer of 1828, and then it's a couple years before he comes back to New Orleans. But in that time frame, the family moves, and some things change in their family,
right,
it seems.
Right. They move to Illinois. I should mention that Lincoln starts to he's really of age now.
Mm-hmm.
Taking a flatboat to New Orleans formed socially speaking, for a young man, it was a rite of passage in that you went down a boy and you came back a man. You proved yourself. You showed to your peers and your elders that you were responsible. And there's a whole literature in anthropology on rites of passage and their significance. And so this is one of the important historical messages of Lincoln's flatboat trip, that they were enormously informing of his youth. And I would encourage listeners to think back on your own youth and the role that your first long, risky trip away from home on your own transformed you. That this concept of the long trip on your own. And as again, as being a geographer who studied this topic, one of the things I did, one of the most fun maps I've ever made and researched, was mapping out Lincoln's life. Where he lived by the amount of time. Mm-hmm. And the map is in the book. You see his Kentucky youth. You see his Indiana childhood, his Illinois coming of age, his Washington years, his campaign tours. And you see, so most of the action is in the Midwest and Upper Midwest and Northeast. And then you look all the way. There's nothing in the South until you come to New Orleans, and there's a little yellow dot in New Orleans. So this was his first long trip to what at the time was seen as an exotic, multicultural, multilingual entrepot and a polyglot. So this was not only the farthest and longest trips of his entire life, but really the closest he ever came to experiencing a foreign culture.
Well, and at the time, one of the fastest growing cities
fastest
in America.
Fastest growing cities, largest city in the South by far. It peaks as the third largest city in the nation in 1840. That's a little bit later. So this for a little country boy who had never been in a big city, much less such a sophisticated and complex and contentious and frankly, a police state, a police state for a good portion of the population must have been just an overwhelming experience.
And he would have heard easily a dozen or more languages.
You bet. All for the first time.
Yeah.
That's right.
So he's certainly, this seminal event has to change him. In fact, as you were talking about the first, just this moment ago, you were talking about the first major journey far from home. We're sitting in Richard's office on the campus at Tulane University, and I just watched a group of about 15 very bright-eyed, probably incoming freshmen walk by and sort of couldn't let that go with. In some respects, this is probably their first trip like
that's
that
right.
as well.
And they will reflect back on this 30 years from now, how much they changed once they once they took that great trip.
So he does that. The family moves to Illinois. Now he certainly has probably a different worldview than he did just
That's
a
right.
few years earlier.
That's right.
And he comes back down again with a different type of guy, but again, sort of a similar arrangement. He's a hired gun, if you will, to come back down the river.
He comes back down. They actually take a foray to St. Louis. He's with a larger crew this time. So he arrives in, once again, leaves in April, arrives in May, not quite the exact same dates, but so this is essentially 3 years later, stays for a similar period of time. And the significance of this second trip is more along the lines of what were called at that time internal improvements. There's another commonality today. What's the biggest talk of the nation? Reinvesting in American infrastructure. We didn't call it infrastructure 200 years ago. We called it internal improvements, but it meant the same thing. Canals, improving river navigation, roads, bridges, railroads. So Lincoln experiences all the problems of river navigation on both trips. But upon arriving in New Orleans in 1831, the talk of the town, the most exciting project in town, is the completion of the very first railroad, of its full charter, west of the Appalachians. And it's right here in New Orleans. It's called the Pontchartrain Railroad, Smoky Mary. You're on Elysian Fields Avenue.
Heading out to what one day became Pontchartrain Beach,
Milnenburg, right, exactly. And it's not steam-driven at this time. It's mule-driven. Nevertheless, the rails are in place, and the whole idea of rail-based, smooth, efficient rail-based conveyance, he would have seen for the very first time. Now, again, conjecture, but inquisitive young man, fascinating city, everyone in town is going to Elysian Fields Avenue to see the inaugural run of the Pontchartrain Railroad.
And it was the predecessor of, we did an episode back, episode 16, about the history of the streetcar. And it was certainly the country sort of gone crazy about this railroad.
Exactly. Right? It's coming in from England, this whole technology. And 2 years later, we get a rail, not 300 feet from where we're sitting here, the beginnings of the streetcar, the St. Charles streetcar line. Essentially the same technology, right?
Mm-hmm.
We distinguish between freight lines and passenger, urban passenger rail, but what went along the Pontchartrain Railroad was a mix of both of freight as well as passengers. So he once again returns on steamboat, and he runs for local office shortly after arriving back in New Salem, Illinois, in the summer of 1831. And the two top things on his platform, one of them is improved river navigation, and the other is railroads for the West.
Mm.
Okay? Fresh back from having definitely experienced the first and probably experiencing the second one.
Right, sure. It would have been the talk of the town. It would have been very likely that he and certainly he would have read about it if not been there.
And overheard conversations.
Sure. So he goes back, right, I think it's incredible that at first blush when you think about Lincoln, you don't think about the connection to New Orleans, of course, and now you find he begins his political career largely on a platform that was formed.
Drawn from his experiences.
Here, right?
Yeah, or at least informed by them.
And then I think, again, as we now jump forward many years, he runs for president, he gets elected, and I'm jumping, obviously, a couple of decades now. He runs for president, and as soon as he's elected, within 2 months, states start seceding from the Union, including Louisiana.
A crisis of unprecedented proportions.
And I think, and then yet another twist, the first shots are fired on Fort Sumter by a gentleman who is from the New Orleans area, P.G.T. Beauregard, one of the four statues that was just taken down.
That's right.
And you just think about this sort of these odd kind of loops back to Lincoln's life.
And speaking of loops, Lincoln's strategy and the Navy strategy, Farragut's strategy, was to form a loop around the Confederacy and strangle it off. Mm. It was called the Anaconda Plan. So picture the Confederate States of America. What do you have along the northern edge? The Ohio River. What do you have near, if not forming the western edge? Of course, you have the Mississippi River. Along the southern edge, you have the Gulf of Mexico. Along the east, you have the eastern seaboard. Mm. So imagine an anaconda encircling this, choking it off from the rest of the world, and suppressing the rebellion. And that's what it was. The Civil War started as a rebellion suppression. So think of this anaconda. Which city is in the crosshairs?
Mm.
It's the one at the crossroads of the Gulf Coast and the Mississippi River. So once again, all these years later, New Orleans falls front and center to Lincoln's attention. And I have to think, as he's mulling with his war cabinet on how to take New Orleans and how to execute this plan, that he's drawing from his memories all those years before.
Yeah.
And I have to think when he's mulling slavery, which rises in importance in terms of the motivation to keep fighting the war between 61 and 63 and 65, that he's drawing from his experiences seeing it in New Orleans.
Well, and that's the thing, that the sort of overarching story that I took away from your book, again, Lincoln in New Orleans, which talks about the flatboat journeys in 1828 and 1831, is that on the surface, even to someone interested in presidential history, I thought I knew a lot about Abraham Lincoln, but I never thought about the tie to New Orleans, much less the impact that those journeys likely made on his judgment. And even as president, they start to develop that plan. He had firsthand experience of New Orleans. And obviously, like you said, sort of at the probably most seminal moment, these first journeys away as a young boy and then as a growing man, the impact that time period in anyone's life makes. And so here you get this, what could seemingly be random on some level, now comes back and impacts not only the future president of the United States, but the future of the country.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was such a fascinating, you look at New Orleans today through the lens of tourism and history and the different things that we've talked about, including Bourbon Street, but then it doesn't take too much of a dig to find all these ripples that could have really changed events.
Ripples indeed.
And so I think it's an interesting, people come to New Orleans, we were talking just before we came on, people come to New Orleans and it has such an impact on their lives. But here is arguably the most important, or one of the most important Americans in the history of our country. And at least in some way, New Orleans had an influence on that.
And the only official salute to Lincoln in modern-day New Orleans is one tiny street in the 7th Ward. It's one block long. It's called Lincoln Court. There's no statues. There's no street names. To be sure, there were a couple of features here and there, but they were usually racially segregated. Lincoln Beach.
Right.
And there's some Lincoln references in and around the surrounding areas. But for the most part, he's little recognized within New Orleans today in terms of place names and toponyms.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Again, Richard,
should this be changed? I will let listeners decide.
And I just thought again, as you know, the point I was making at the beginning about the statues, it's so interesting. Again, these loops, these circles, these impacts. And it'll be interesting to see how our future history plays out as New Orleans is coming up on our 300th anniversary as a city, our 300th birthday.
And 10 years after that will be the 200th anniversary of Lincoln first setting foot in New Orleans. 2028.
Interesting. I would definitely encourage people to check out the book. I'll put the links over in the show notes over at beyondbourbonst.com. Again, you can connect with Richard at richcampanella.com and at on Twitter at Nola Campanella. And again, I'll put all those links there. You can find his book online, but certainly if you're in town, I'd encourage you to check out Octavia Books or Garden District Bookshops.
Or drop a line to me. I actually have a stash of them. So just I'm an easy email.
Yes.
Just Google Rich Campanella. You'll find my email. Send me an email, and I'll be happy to walk you through all that detective work.
It's terrific, and I'll put links to all that over on the website. Once again, Richard, it's a pleasure to get to talk to you. Thanks so much for taking time with us today.
You're welcome, and thank you. I really enjoyed it.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Richard. It's really interesting to me when you stop and think about the impact that these voyages had on a young Abraham Lincoln and how they might have affected not only New Orleans, but all of the United States. And again, kind of circling back to the idea of the four Confederate-era statues that were recently removed in New Orleans, I think it's really interesting that that debate probably doesn't happen if Lincoln doesn't come to New Orleans and later become president of the United States. Anyway, I thought it was an interesting dive into history that maybe a lot of people didn't know about. I certainly learned a lot about it, and I enjoyed the discussion. You can find notes for today's show over at beyondbourbonst.com/40, including information about how to contact Richard if you'd like to pick up an autographed copy of his book. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have an idea for a future episode or you just want to reach out to me, my email is mark@beyondbourbonst.com. One other thing before we close. I recently created a Facebook group where we can share ideas, ask questions, and tell stories about all things New Orleans. You can get there by going to beyondbourbonst.com/Facebook, and I hope to see you over there soon. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the show, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you and me. We're working on upcoming shows about movies in New Orleans, the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, and much more. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.